Ngiyabona maselikhonza nawe nje ngithi kubi. Okay, let me officially declare the meeting open and apologize for arriving a few minutes late. As usual, we normally have our management in the morning before this meeting. So we were delayed there. Today we're supposed to be considering an annual report from the competition authorities, that is the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal. We will start with the competition. This thing is really disturbing. Mm-hmm. Why is it in my more towards this side than that side? Thank you. Yeah, that's better. We will be starting with the Competition Commission, obviously, looking at how they have performed for the financial year 2011. We're hoping that the meeting will last us until at least 1 o'clock, because we consider initial reports normally not taking that much time. But as you all know, that we have our new growth path. We have that is looking at other issues that which are very important, especially the developmental part of our growth. We really have to consider the role that is played by the Competition Commission in driving change or economic change in the country. And it is important that when we look at this report, we look at the report with that eye. We will give the Commissioner Ramburu an opportunity to present to us, so that we don't eat much of your time again. We laid with about 20 minutes, so we'll allow you to let the 20 minutes in addition. No. We'll run within the allocated time. I really made a mistake by giving you more time. Yeah. We'll consider that we started 20 minutes late, and therefore the presentation time will be extended according to the program with 20 minutes. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much, members, for your attendance, and let's welcome new and old members of the team from the department and also from the competition authorities. I guess you know all members present here. Yeah? How many people are new here? Yes, in the kitchen. Three, okay. Let me allow you an opportunity to know members, because you obviously will be interacting with us and must know who you're interacting with. I'll start at the end there.
There's no
answer. Oh, it's a last one. Okay. This is the youngest member of the committee, Babu Sengwa. He is Babu Sengwa, and he gets very happy when I say Babu Sengwa. He is a member representing the IFP in the committee. Next to him is... Okay, Babu Mabasa, who is a member representing the ANC, also management committee member. Next to him we have Babu Hussein, who's a member representing the ID in the committee. Next to him is Obabu Mugu, who's the member representing the DA in the committee. Next to him, we have Ubango Nyama, who is the member representing COPE in the committee. And then next to him, we have Babu Kwabaza, who's the member representing the ANC in the committee. Next to him, we have Madam Zu Vander Merwe, representing the ANC in the committee. Next to her, we have Madam Zodipsi, representing the ANC, is also a member of the management committee. And then we also have the whip of the committee, Ubabu Tuli, Christine Tuli, who's representing the ANC, and as a whip, also a member of the management committee. Those are the members present. And then we have my name is Matula Coleman, the chairperson of the committee. And then we have our staff members. Next to me here is our researcher, who Nwabisa Mbelekani. And then just opposite, we have Nultando Kaka, who's the committee secretary. Yeah, those are the ones I can see. That is the team, Economic Development Portfolio Committee team. I hope NAM can relax, and we're here to share your report for the year, and then to be able then to see how best can we help. We're not here to interrogate nor to find fault, but to help each other in making sure that we assist the people of South Africa in achieving what we have, our government has set for South Africans to achieve in the year that is under review, which is 2011 financial year. So tell us what you've done for our country, and see whether we can be able to see how best can we assist in doing things better this financial year. Over to Babu Rambo.
Okay, thank you very much, Sherry. If I can just introduce, and thank you very much for the opportunity again to present here. These are always kind of robust and interesting and supportive interactions that we have, and we appreciate that. If I can very also quickly introduce my team. On my right is Dudi Makaya, who heads up our Advocacy and Stakeholder Relations Division. On my left, first is Tembinkosi Bonakere, who's the Deputy Commissioner. Next to him is Mahendran, who's our CFO. You've interacted with him before. Next to him is Oliver Josie, who heads up our cartels division. And next to him is Mkhale, who's also a senior member of staff in the cartels division. And next to him is Anastasia, who's our recently appointed corporate governance person, our company secretary. I'm not going to go beyond that because that's the tribunal staff. Or should I? Okay, Chair, I'm going to try to be brief in the presentation itself so we can have more discussion and deal directly with the questions that you have. Our annual report is quite comprehensive and kind of detailing a lot of the issues that I will speak about. Just to kind of orientate us in the right up front, this is common cause that the work of the competition authorities essentially is made up of three functions. We prosecute firms that ought to be firms that are operating in a competitive environment uncompetitively. We prosecute those firms in terms of certain specified transgressions that are listed in the Competition Act. Secondly, we prevent future concentration in the economy by regulating mergers. Mergers are compulsorily notified to us, and we have to examine whether they lead to anti-competitive structures in the economy if a merger goes ahead. And we're also required to do advocacy work where we advise and attempt to persuade economic players and indeed regulators, more increasingly, more importantly, to adopt pro-competitive policies and behave in pro-competitive ways. For the organization itself, for the period under review, our strategic objectives are essentially, firstly, to be able to select our cases very carefully, to select those cases, in other words, to prioritize our work and to select cases and sectors that we think our intervention will have a really meaningful impact on the way that those sectors or those markets operate. So it's a prioritization process of choosing the cases that are the ones that will get us furthest in terms of changing behavior and making a difference. We also, as our strategic plan, were committed in this last period to improve our strategic engagements, particularly with other government departments and other regulators around how policies are developed in terms of in order to ensure more competitive outcomes. And the third of our strategic objectives essentially is to build a strong organization, to build a competition commission that as an institution performs in a very high, in a very efficient and effective way. Just to first kind of go through some very quickly the highlights of this year under review. It's always very difficult to give a presentation like this so long after the year ends because, you know, a lot of things have even happened since the closure of this report. But even this last year very significantly had a number of cases in the media sector, which has emerged as a sector that we've got 2-3 cases in that sector that previously we didn't. We've had, and this has been widely reported in the newspapers, we've also had many of our cases being taken all the way up to the Constitutional Court, where essentially, to start off with, a lot of respondents in our cases were challenging certain of our procedures, and there were appeals and cross-appeals, and it went through the court system, and 3 cases ended up at the Constitutional Court. More interestingly, this year as well, we began a project to look at how we can assess the impact of our interventions in specific markets. So where we've got a few case studies on this. We're beginning to develop a methodology on how to assess what the impact of our intervention has been in a particular market. These are quite difficult things to do in terms of a methodology and in terms of research. And we've also had one of the bigger themes of the year was to deal with the way in which firms exchange information to facilitate collusion. A number of our cases had dealt with that as the subject matter. And in the under review, we've also looked at more attention placed on the public interest issues that we have to take into account in merger evaluation. And this primarily, you will be aware, was something that was kicked off by Walmart merger, where that became a big issue. So broadly speaking, those are the kind of big issues for the year for us. But just to take these through now in a little bit detail, one at a time. You see, the enforcement cases that we investigated, it's useful to look at this graph over a long period of time because you'll see that the cases we are looking at over time, the numbers of cases have been increasing been steadily increasing over time, particularly since the 2006 period. In this last year, our enforcement division has investigated or has had a look at 258 cases, a lot of which arose out of complaints from the public itself, but some of which were initiated by the Commission. This is not to say that all of these cases that we looked at were cases we took forward. A number of these cases were cases we looked at and didn't and decided not to pursue in terms of a full-scale investigation. I think, but looking specifically then at the cases that we referred to the tribunal in the course of this year, there were 8 cases, and we've listed these. There's a lot of detail in these cases. I'm not going to go into them all and what they're all about, but you'll see, interestingly, that there were cases, media cases, that's number 1 and number 6, and a lot of the other cases were cases that were in the pipeline for a considerable period of time. You'll see that in the sectors that they are the very sectors that we prioritized years ago. And this is just to make the point that when you kind of prioritize and when you proceed with your prioritization, the turnaround time, in other words, from the time you decide to prioritize a sector until such time that a final hearing is held and a decision is made, can be a considerable period of time, particularly if, as in our case, we've had procedural challenges along the way from some of the respondents that we've been dealing with. We've had a number of, notwithstanding the fact that a number of cases are still being investigated, we've had a significant number of cases being heard in the tribunal. Most of these were merger cases. These don't count now the merger cases where there's been a hearing or there's been some contestation. A lot of the merger cases just simply go through the institutions without much controversy or much discussion because there is really no competition issue arising out of them. And I think significant here as well is that we have a very high number of consent orders going to the tribunal. So these are not cases that are contested in the tribunal. In other words, the commission and the respondents reach an agreement and we take it to the tribunal. They have the right, obviously, to kind of relook at it and ask questions, but this is taken not on a contested basis. In other words, when we go with the parties to the tribunal, this is not an adversarial thing. It's an agreement that we are asking the tribunal to endorse after it has a look at the matter. And also, the importance here is, I think, the number of procedural cases, which is quite significant. So we still have having to deal with a lot of cases around procedure and clarification of the law, which means that cases get heard and decisions get taken around the procedural matter, but we're still not getting to the bottom of what the anti-competitive harm is, because we've got to sort out what the procedural issue is first. The matters that go to appeal are also of a procedural nature, and we've had many of our main cases taken on appeal to higher courts beyond the tribunal in this period. I think significant here was the Senvest matter, one of the matters that went all the way to the Constitutional Court. Some of these cases, well, certainly the South African Breweries case, for example, was also a victim of the adverse decisions taken by the higher court. So when court set a precedent in an earlier case, the South African Breweries case didn't proceed in the tribunal because the party took it on appeal based on a precedent set in a previous case. Once again, you'll see that these cases also are located around or relate very closely to the priority sectors that we chose way back when. They're all in those sectors, and I think significant here is a complicated case, which is perhaps is a case that, whereas most of our cases have to do with collusion, this was a case that has to do with abuse of dominance. Okay, so that's on the cases that we've had being heard. There's a lot of detail in each one of these, and if there's any particular matter you want to talk about in more detail, we're happy to do so. But in the year under review, one of the most significant things that has been happening is the number of construction cases we'd be dealing with that arose out of, in the first instance, our corporate leniency policy. So we've reported on this previously. The Commission has a corporate leniency policy where, in terms of which any party comes to, any party involved in a cartel or in collusion comes to us and provide us truthfully with all the information that will enable us to prosecute the remaining members of the cartel, they will not, they are exempt from prosecution. And this is, our corporate leniency policy has been extremely successful since it began. A number of our successful prosecutions and consent agreements were as a consequence of us having corporate leniency. It does make it very difficult for a cartel member to challenge the charges we make against them when one of the fellow cartelists is telling against them and providing us with evidence. And this is something that has really resulted in us, resulted in a lot of activity around in the Commission around question of cartels in the construction industry with respect to how tendering occurs, how tendering in the procurement process occurs. I will talk about that a little bit in more detail. But the point here is that our CLP has been a very, very important and successful instrument in getting us as an organization to successfully prosecute cases. Then there's two slides that kind of list all the administrative penalties that we have levied in the year under review. The total amount of penalties that have been collected by the competition authorities in this year under review amounts to over R500 million. So that's 448 million rand in total for the period under review. You'll see that a number of the cases here, once again, are in the priority sectors. There's many cases relating to the grain silo industry, which are sometimes very modest fines, but there were many of them involved. Significant here is the cases relating to the petroleum industry, Engen and Shell. You'll see those were sizable amounts, as were the cases, as were the penalties we levied against the cement industry. And that's AfriSam and Lafarge. You see those are kind of larger amounts of 124 and 148 million respectively. I think also significant in terms of the amount of administrative penalties we've levied, you will see that it far exceeds, I mean, threefold, at least to threefold, three times almost the total expenditure of the organization. So we kind of, you know, we put more money into the fiscus as an organization than we're taking out. All of this money, people will be aware that we are, it's not money we keep, it goes straight to the National Revenue Fund. I think, interestingly, in terms of the administrative penalties, to also look at them over time, and you'll see that, you know, before 2005, there wasn't any data on this because there were very few or perhaps no, you know, the fine came to a very small amount, and they kind of steadily increased from 2008 in terms of the administrative penalties that are collected by, that are levied by the institution. Just to talk a little bit now about the fast track construction project which we have. This is not something that, this is a project that we haven't reached conclusion over yet. We kind of very near the point of kind of tying everything up around it, and we have in previous times reported on this project, but if I can just go through it again very briefly, is you will recall that one of our priority sectors was the infrastructure and construction sectors, construction sector primarily because of the large amount of infrastructure spend that government is committed to and in the period prior to the World Cup, lots of stadiums and roads were being built, and there was enormous amount of government expenditure here. And we first began looking at product markets in the construction sector. In other words, the cement, which you see the results of in our, you know, which we, there's been some successful prosecutions on, cement, bricks, steel, bitumen, which is the stuff that you make roads out of. And so we looked at the, and steel, so we looked at a lot of the, we started off looking at the product markets. But as we began our work in that, it became very apparent to us, particularly through the large number of corporate leniency policy applications we received, that what was a very huge anti-competitive practice in this history, in this industry, and something that has evolved historically over a long period of time, was the way in which firms colluded with each other when they were involved in a tendering process. And essentially, you know, in a tendering process, you assume that each firm is acting independently and trying to give you the lowest price, or you can choose the lowest price. But if firms get together and decide amongst themselves, look, let's not compete with each other. Let's decide up front who's going to win the tender. And, you know, if you're the guy who's going to win the tender, the rest of us will put in very high bids so that we ensure that you win the tender. And that is a very common way in which the industry operates, has been operating. So that phenomenon that I just explained is called cover pricing, where, you know, we decide beforehand you win and I'll just put in any old bid. I haven't worked it out in any detail. You will definitely win it. So there's that, and there's other practices here as well. If somebody loses a bill, they get a loser's fee. You know, we decide you're going to win it and you don't win it, and the rest of us must kind of pay you some kind of loser's fee because we decided amongst ourselves up front that you would win it. And so the bids get rotated amongst the different construction companies. You know, some of it comes from a culture where people are saying, well, you know, there's enough work for all of us. Why should we be competing? Let's just share the spoils amongst us up front rather than kind of competing. And, of course, what the end result of that is that the people procuring these services, in most instances government, are paying far more than they would have been paying had these bids been made competitively. So we've, with the large number of cases that it could potentially take up in bid rigging, we found that, you know, if we kind of went case by case by case, it would take us 20 years to finish this work because there were so many cases. You know, there was just, if we prosecuted each case one at a time, it would be enormously expensive, both for us as an institution and for private parties hiring lawyers to kind of contest all of these cases. So what we did is we put together a what we call fast-track construction program, where we designed a schema where if construction firms came to us and declared all the projects in which they were bid rigging, they told us about all of them, we would fine them for all of that conduct collectively, and the fines would be considerably less than they would have been had we done them one at a time. Okay, and there's a construction of, you know, if you between 1 to 5 firms, you'll get this amount. 1 to 5 projects, you get this amount. 5 to 10 projects, you'll get another amount. But they're certainly not. Remember, in terms of the act, for each one of these transgressions, we could theoretically at least fine a firm 10% of the turnover for each transaction. So if a firm has 10 transactions and you have 10% for each, that's the whole of their turnover. And all these firms had more than 10 projects, a few of them. So it became, you know, we had to kind of incentivize them to come to us and come clean on all of their bid rigging activities, and what they would get in return is a fine that's lower than what it would have been if we'd went each one by one. We undertook this as I said, because of kind of very tactical reasons around the amount of resources and energy one would have to put in if you went the full hog, in other words, if you prosecuted each case. But also there was a precedent of this kind of scheme, this kind of program, both in the UK and in the Netherlands, where both competition authorities there, under similar circumstances, devised similar schemes to kind of get rid of their caseload. But more importantly, it's not just a matter of getting rid of caseload, it's about this project disrupting market relations, the relationships within this market to an extent that collusion must never occur again. In other words, going forward, it is because our intervention has broken up the cartels. In other words, you can imagine the distrust that these cartel members will now have on each other, because they're all telling on each other. They're all telling us about the other one's involvement in these bid rigging projects, and we've essentially broken and crushed this cartel. It doesn't function as a coherent institution, if you like, in the manner that it has over decades before. So in the year under review, we spent a fair amount of time kind of processing, receiving these applications and processing it. So you won't find the results of it in this year's annual report, although it took up most of the time of our cartels unit. That'll come in next year's annual report. And essentially, the summary on the slide tells us that we received applications from 21 firms, including the top five firms. There were 301 projects that we counted amongst all the projects that were given to us. There were other firms that didn't apply but were implicated by firms that did apply. The value of these projects and tenders is an estimated 29 billion, although I must point out these are not audited figures and we can't kind of vouch for them. That's just an estimate. And we've done settlement and we're in the process right now of concluding settlements with each one of these parties around which projects they were to take responsibility of having bridge rigged in the past. Okay, so, and just remember also, in these projects, we have this prescription rule in our law where you can't prosecute somebody for a behavior beyond, 3 years prior. Okay, so we can only fine them for the projects that were rigged over in the last 3 years. Beyond that, the prescription rule says that we can't, somebody cannot be prosecuted for anti-competitive conduct in terms of the Competition Act. We can talk more about this if there's any questions around it later. We've also had, in the course of this year, a number of exemption applications. We approved one of them. Exemption applications are where our Act allows for parties that are involved in interactions with each other basically, to get an exemption, you must say to the Commission, look, we are involved in some kind of, we are as competitors collaborating with each other on in a particular thing. And even though it might be seen as collusion in a strict interpretation of the Act, we want you to take into account what we're actually doing, and the Act specifies the grounds on which you can make these arguments, and you must allow us to continue these behaviors because they have some pro-competitive benefit, actually, and they benefit consumers in some way or the other. And so even though, strictly speaking, perhaps it might be anti-competitive, allow us to continue with, because there's some good that comes out of it. We approved one, which is the Star Alliance. So Star Alliance would be an example. These are all airlines getting together and collaborating with each other at some level, because that creates efficiencies and in the end you get different groups of airlines that are competing with each other. In other words, the Star Alliance with the whatever the other alliances are. Okay, we approved one. We approved three with conditions. Sapir, which is in the agro-processing industry, Western Cape Citrus Producers Forum. This is interesting. This is where South African citrus producers had to get together in order to export citrus to the United States. And if they didn't get together and do it in a combined way, that export would have not occurred. In other words, each producer would not be able to do it individually by themselves. They could only do it by doing it collectively. And we were satisfied that that wasn't anti-competitive in our market, and even in the European, in the U.S. market, it would have not been anti-competitive, because South African citrus growers would have a very small percentage of the citrus market in the United States. So they wouldn't go there and be a dominant citrus producer. So we were satisfied that in order to promote exports, which is one of the criteria on which an exemption decision gets taken, in order to promote exports, it was necessary for this collaboration to occur. SAA Qantas is also around creating efficiencies in the route from South Africa to Australia. They have to coordinate with each other, but if attach conditions on that. We've rejected two applications, one from the Health Professionals Council, and this was for health professionals to, this is a professional association, and insofar as professional associations are protecting or safeguarding professional standards, that's a fair, that's fair for a professional association. Professional council to do, but they could, in doing so, very easily overstep the mark and begin to adopt practices that become fundamentally anti-competitive. And so we rejected those, and one from Springlight Gas, which is a company in Durban that sends pipe gas to households, and they were wanting an exclusivity around being able to do that. Then coming to mergers.
Yeah. Again on the Springlight Gas. What is it all about?
The Springlight Gas had to do with an arrangement that Springlight Gas and Sasol had with each other about dividing the market between them in the supply of piped gas to households. Looking at mergers, this slide merely looks at the numbers of mergers we've looked at in the course of the year, divided into phase one, phase two, and phase three. Basically, phase one are uncomplicated mergers. These mergers usually don't have any competition problems with them. Phase two have some, but we've got to apply our minds. Then phase three are the more complicated mergers, and we see that those have been kind of increasing over time. The green lines have been increasing over time, so we're getting increasingly more complicated mergers to look at. And also the slide demonstrates shows how our merger workload is increasing over time and will increase over time, because until we lower the threshold for notification, which was something we previously did in April 2009. Just to go back, there's compulsory notification of mergers, which we define as intermediate and large mergers, and that definition is based on a calculation there's a formula which calculates whether a merger is small, medium, and large based on the asset turnover, on the asset value, I beg your pardon, and the turnover of merging parties. So based on the asset value and the turnover, we kind of work out whether a merger is small, intermediate, and large. All intermediate and large mergers have to be notified to the authorities. Small mergers need not, although the authorities have the power to call to ask for such a small merger to be notified. Intermediate mergers are mergers where the Competition Commission can take a decision as to whether to approve it or not. And should a party be unhappy with our decision, they will take it to the tribunal for a second look. In the case of large mergers, the commission makes a recommendation to the tribunal. The tribunal must listen to the commission's view and the party's view and anybody else's view, and then it makes a call on whether to approve the merger or not. And so here, in terms of the thresholds, you can imagine that if we set a threshold of a particular numerical value, over time, that numerical value falls because the price of money gets higher and higher. Okay, taking into account inflation, to put it crudely, you know. So over time, we're going to get more and more mergers, and there will be a point at which periodically we've got to adjust those merger thresholds, bring down the numbers, taking into account the price of money, inflation, basically. Okay. The decisions, once again, consistent with our previous years and consistent with all competition authorities throughout the world, most of our merger decisions are mergers approved without conditions. Very few are prohibited. But in this particular year, we've actually had a fairly significant increase in the number of mergers where we approved it with conditions, and 8 mergers is perhaps the largest number of mergers we've prohibited in any one year, and so that's the kind of trend here. Is the trend, I suppose, is increasingly we are putting conditions on mergers, and the kinds of conditions we're attaching to the mergers is shown in this graph. Most of the conditions relate to putting a moratorium on job losses. So when parties tell us, you know, one of the questions we have to consider is how many jobs are lost as a consequence of a merger, and often we've put caps to them, saying to parties, this merger can go ahead provided you do not retrench more than X number of workers. We've also had other kinds of conditions. One is to restrict appointment of directors in competing firms. So just to explain that is often collusion between firms could be facilitated by a common director that sits on both boards of both firms. And that's the person, that's the vehicle through which information gets exchanged to facilitate collusion. In some instances, we've had to say, you know, this can go ahead provided there are no common directors in this firm and the competitive firm. We've had a few cases, well, 3, I think, where there's been divestiture, where we've said, well, this can go ahead provided that part of the business gets hived off and sold to some other third independent party. So that's a very structural remedy. But then there's other kind of behavioral remedies like the obligation to supply. So we'll say this merger can go ahead, provide you continue to supply the people you're supplying or historically have supplied, and you're not kind of going to cut anybody off in terms of who you're supplying as a consequence of this merger. And that's the same about exclusivity clauses, and in some instances we've also put in obligations by parties to invest further in their plants or in particular geographical areas. An example there, I suppose, would be the kind of condition that came out in Walmart. And of course there's other restrictions around ensuring that information doesn't get exchanged between competitors. We've got a kind of list here of the mergers that have been prohibited in the financial year under review. Some of these have been subsequently heard in the tribunal, like in the recent past, for example, the Kenilworth Racing Gold Circle case has been in the news around something that's been heard recently. But as far as the commission's concerned, these were decisions we took in the previous financial year. We've also been very active, and briefly to tell you about our activities in terms of reaching out to different stakeholders. We've had workshops and bridge reading for procurement officials and government. We've commented on legislation in Parliament, and in some instances have gone to other portfolio committees to give presentations, and we've given presentations to government departments, universities, and business associations. We have been quite active in our in media, and there's statistics to look at the kinds of media activities we've been involved in, and we've been very involved. We've been fairly involved again in our international work, involved in international fora, policy making organizations like the OECD and WIPO. We're very involved in BRICS. BRICS has a special subcommittee dealing with competition, and we kind of participate with BRICS countries in that forum. But I think most interesting for us in terms of international relations is we've got a program where people, staff from other competition agencies, and in our case in particular other African competition agencies, are seconded to our organization for sometimes extended period of time, up to 3 months in some instances, but people come for a week or a month and come and work in the organization to get the kind of experience of working in a competition authority, which they take back to their respective competition authorities back home. The staff complement of the competition authorities, you can see that most of our staff are made up of technical staff, lawyers and economists. That's our biggest asset. That is where, you know, where the analysis occurs, the investigations occur, and so most of our staff are technical staff. Our staff profile in terms of race and gender is completely proportionate to population sizes of these different demographics. So, yeah, you know, 50-50 in terms of male and female, and in terms of race, it's kind of proportionate to the general population. The organization puts a lot of, as I said, staff is our main big asset. We put a lot of energy and time into training staff. A lot of the staff is done in-house on the job training, because the only way you can really learn and understand this area is by doing the work itself. But there's been a fair amount of external training as well, including some international training, and we have a bursary scheme for staff to take study loans from the organization, and should they pass the exams, it get converted into a bursary. The governance of the organization is sound. We meet regularly. The commission meets once a week, regularly, like clockwork, and takes... Okay. How to explain this? So supposing you have 10 staff members, and they all went for two training courses. Yes, the frequency. Yeah, they all went for two training courses each. So do you count them as 10 training courses or 20 training courses? Right. So it's adjusting for that. Okay. Okay. So on governance, as I was saying, we have our, you know, there's a regular stream of decisions that come out of the commission. This is absolutely necessary because we are time bound, particularly in the merger decisions. And it's important to kind of meet regularly to kind of ensure that even those where we're not time bound, there's sufficient management to ensure that cases move properly through the organization. So we've had like 47 commission meetings in a year, which is almost once a week, every week. The audit committee and the risk committee also meets regularly. We've had no material breakdown in the function of internal financial controls in the organization as determined by our auditors. We've complied with the legislation, and in this year under review, we've had an unqualified audit opinion. There were some emphasis of matter, as they put it, as the auditors put it, was in relation to our supply chain management. in terms of how we appoint lawyers and advocates that they were not happy with, and we've put into place controls now to ensure that that occurs as per the rules 100%. Although this was not something that qualified our audit in any way. It was an emphasis of matter. I mean, essentially, here to tell you is there was an expectation of the Auditor General's office that when you appointing senior counsel, you needed to do it by the book, which meant you needed to get a quote from three senior counsel and choose on the basis of that. Now, you don't take decisions around appointing counsel in the same way that you take decisions around buying stationery. And right. So you look, it's a more complex thing, and you want to look at it, you know, it's more complicated. So we put into place to satisfy them in terms of ensuring there's checks and balances in the system, but not, you know, suddenly you can't appoint lawyers in the same way that you buy a stationery. It is more complicated. And then just looking at the financial performance this year, you should compare this to the amount of fines we levied to look at how much we spent. And even the amount we spent, you know, our government grant is not the kind of total amount of the amount we spent. So it's 126 million from government, but we also get a fee income from the filing of mergers, which in this year was 50 million rand, which we share, which was our share of that, because we share it between us and the tribunal, the fee income. You'll see here once again that most of the money we spend is in staff, on personnel. That's our biggest asset, as I've said. You'll see, I think, importantly, that in the last financial year, our deficit was slashed significantly from the previous year. And, you know, this was a deficit that was impossible. I mean, our surplus, beg your pardon. And this was kind of, you know, part of what we're going to do is guess how many mergers will be notified in a year. And I think that most of the surplus was accounted by us not guessing properly. It's impossible to guess any precision how many mergers are going to happen in an economy in 1 year. So that's our financial performance review. I should say, once again, as is in our annual report, we had an audit that was unqualified in this year. Thank you. That's my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Ramburuk, are there any additions? Nothing. Members, here is a detailed report on, I guess you all have the annual report tabled. This was just a summary of that annual report. For details, please let's go back to the full report. The annual report has also the audited financial statement. It was posted to all of you. Okay. I'm happy that you agree. Thank you. May we interact with the presentation? I'm noting Bahlengwa. Mubu Ngonyam. So it's been an hour.
Thanks, Chair, and good morning to the committee members and the delegation here today. I've just got two questions, Chair, really. The first one refers to the issue that was touched on. I noticed that the construction and infrastructure sector, you know, in the year was pretty much, you know, high and has been growing significantly.
I'm finding it difficult to hear you.
Oh,
I don't know about it. Can you talk to the mic? Okay.
No, thanks, Chair. Am I audible now? Thank you. I'll be very brief. I've just got two questions. On the issue of the construction and infrastructure, if you can get a, you know, further explanation on the impact of tenders. Once I heard that there was a problem, you know, with the whole tendering activity going on. And the other one is the issue of turnaround time on cases on average. On how do you, what's the average turnaround time on matters that are on the table and for the commission? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Babu Mabasa.
Thanks, Colleague Chair. And thanks to the Commissioner and the team for the input made. My first question is, when we talk of possible collusion, are we confining ourselves to South Africa, or is our view broader, such that we speak of Southern Africa, the international world? That's one question. The second question is, standing institutions as they stand now, to what degree do you influence each other in terms of curricula, in terms of guiding them towards producing for you? But I must express appreciation at the fact that you are able to contribute in the production of skilled labor by having an in-house training. Will you go to a degree of saying this is what you will recommend other departments also do? I know that I'm now asking beyond what you have presented. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thanks, Lakosta.
Thank you very much. I want to just take you to the third slide, the one with all the Manhattan, if you call it. Sorry, guys. The enforcement cases and the investigation. It's the third one, yeah. I take the point that you made, that there's clearly a significant increase in the number of complaints that have, over the years, that you receive from the public. And perhaps maybe that's a good indication, that the more people know about the work that you do, the more complaints you will receive. But I get the impression we're not getting the same kind of trend from the investigations that you initiate from the Competition Commission. And will it then be fair to say that you simply rely upon the complaints from the public? That's not necessarily a wrong thing. That's the first question. The second one relates to the comment that you made about where those companies involved with bid rigging would kind of declare their involvement with over 10 or 12 different projects, and you will set one penalty for all. If you had a situation where some of these companies were repeat offenders, if they were repeat offenders, how did you deal with that situation? Then the one on the health professional council, I guess that was an application to kind of manage or set professional fees, if I'm correct. And that one was rejected. Now, one can make the argument that actually that would assist to reduce the high cost of professional fees in the health sector. And you can compare it to recent, not too recent legislation, where there was some regulation of professional fees in the pharmaceutical sector, in the pharmacist. How then can you argue, on the one hand, that it was anti-competitive, and yet on the other hand, it promoted to manage or to regulate high fees in the health sector? I found it quite interesting, and I completely understand the difficulty you are in trying to buy good lawyers to help argue your cases before the tribunal. But if you could expand on exactly how you managed to deal with this control, actually, that satisfied
department is be interesting to hear. And then the last one I want to quiz you on is the position that you've taken with regards to South African Airways and why you believe it. The comment that was, that the complaints that you received was not anti-competitive. Surely given the trend that has been in the industry, the low-cost carrier industry, over the last decade, I would think, that a number of companies have suffered as a consequence of bailouts that South African Airways has received from state coffers. And yet you, as the Competition Commission, don't see the impact that it's having on those low-cost airlines. And if you can explain why you think it is not necessary for you to even investigate it, although you received the complaint. The same principle applies, and I apologize if I don't have all of the information in the follow-up on the complaints that you received with regards to the funding of the state mining company and the 248...
So, just on the SAA, which one are you referring to, the complaint? I think there were two, the one by Comair, I guess, and the other one?
The other one was by Natasha Michaels, a member of parliament.
Yes. Can you be specific? Which case are you referring to?
That's the one I'm just referring to now.
The Natasha one?
Correct.
Okay.
But they both relate to the same principle, really. I mean, it doesn't matter where it came from. And maybe you reply
to... No. The reason why I'm asking is because we want to be clear when taking notes as to what exactly are you referring to.
Okay. But can I on that point add both, actually, and maybe give us a response on both? As well as the position that you've taken with the non-interest or the interest-free loan that was given to the state mining company from the Central Energy Fund, and whether or not you're investigating that, what position have you taken on that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, which I think was easy enough for some of us to follow and not technical minded. It was a good presentation. My first question has to do with what he referred to as well, but I want to take a different angle. I see that in terms of carryover cases, in 2010 and 2011, there were quite a number of those. What could be the reason? Is that problem of capacity in the commission to investigate them and to treat of them? My other question is, I think it's already asked, in fact, it was in terms of the case initiated by the commission itself as opposed to what comes out of the public. I thought that that would have been your responsibility, that you initiate more cases because that's your mandate. The large measures that you dealt with, how many of these involved direct foreign investment, something close to what we had in Massmart and Walmart measure, and to what extent would you think this have contributed to job creation if it positively considered by the Commission? And the next is this question of bid rigging. Do you think that firms really cooperate honestly when you bring them forward to disclose their bid rigging? Because I'm thinking, is this tantamount to pre-bargaining between yourselves and the offenders? Why wouldn't you go the whole hog and punish them to the extent that they won't repeat this kind of behavior? So they learn a lesson at least from that. And lastly, in your sub-complement, do you have interns participating in the sub-complement? I see that you have only... and corporate governance, finally, corporate governance. The Commission had been experiencing some... You did. Sorry about my accent. Is it my pronunciation? Okay. The last one is corporate governance. Commission has been experiencing management problems recently. How have you dealt with this, and to what extent is the situation now in the commission?
Thank you. Thanks,
Chair. Let me also add my voice.
Just like Tungwenyama, you won't eat
Tungwenyama. Okay. No, let me start by appreciation of the, and I express my appreciation to the well-prepared presentation, which was very, very understandable. And I must also appreciate, Chair, the report with regard to financials and the budget.
Just a second, Babu Nguyen. Can I go back to Babu Mugu? I want you to clarify your last question. You know, sometimes when we write reports, it becomes a bit difficult because we really don't understand the basis of some of the questions.
The last question.
You're talking about the problems within the...
Yes.
Yes. Establishment.
Yes, I think the commission is aware of it, but we probably give more clarity on that because this is a question. Or maybe Mr. Kofi, that did ask the minister this question. I had a response, which I'm not satisfied with.
You
I'm sure the commission is aware of the fact that there were some challenges in the commission, management challenges.
Okay, share that with us, because, you know, it's okay. I understand that they understand, but I don't think members understand, because they haven't reported on them. If they had reported on those challenges, it would be better.
I think it had to do with, I'm just speaking off my head, top of my head, and I don't have the case in front of me,
uh-huh.
But I think it was about a member of staff was relieved of his duties and challenged the commissioner, in fact, about that dismissal. And when I asked that question to the minister, the response I got was that it was still being investigated, and the matter has not been laid to rest, so that's why I was asking the question.
Then is it proper to say the commission is experiencing management problems?
It was at the time, yes. That's why I'm asking.
Was it the whole management, or is it because of the one case?
This, I'm asking the commissioner. I mean, this is the question of the commissioner, and I think he has a responsibility to ask it.
No. I want to understand, because if you say that there was a management, that's why I wanted clarity, because so that you are able to also assist you.
But can I ask the commissioner whether they're aware of what I'm talking about?
Yes, maybe that's the relevant question. So that you are able then to ask. Well, if you say it experienced management problems, then we become, because we were not aware. And then we become, that's why I'm asking, because I was very chair. I was not aware that there were challenges.
Okay.
But I'm happy that you are raising that, so that perhaps it can be also an information, use this as an information sharing session in that regard. So if you are saying there was a problem, which is very direct, there was a problem with a particular staff member who challenged the issue. How far is that issue? Then I would understand.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. How far is the issue on that staff? And the second question that he asked is whether you agree that there were challenges within your management in this particular. I think that would clarify then. Thanks, Babu Nguyen.
Thanks, Chair. As I was still trying to express my appreciation on the unqualified report and emanating from the auditing process, and I think we have to appreciate that. And the second one is the impact, judging by what is coming in terms of the revenue and on behalf of the country, I think also, Chair, I feel myself that I have to express appreciation, especially judging by the capacity in terms of the numbers of people that the Commission has. And that may also speak to the number of cases that are initiated outside vis-a-vis what is initiated by the Commission. And I'm not trying to speak or campaign and on their behalf, Chair, but logically, looking at the numbers, I'm just thinking myself, if they were to go whole hog in terms of trying to get each and every case, will it really be possible for them to do that, judging by the few people that we have in front of us? That we've been actually saying right from the beginning. And now, the question of the admin penalties, it seems it has dropped from 794 and to 548. And what actually makes that a huge drop? And if I may be clarified on it. The question of the corporate leniency policy, maybe some point, Chairperson, we need to be taken on board in detail on this one, so that we understand exactly what goes beyond the agreement with regard to different companies and the kind of agreement, because the question that actually emerged out of that process, in my view, is a deterrence. Does it actually serve to deter the company so that there is no re-emergence of that tendency again, because it may actually go to last maybe for a year, two, three. Then again, it re-emerges. And again, is there some kind of an agreement or some mechanisms of monitoring so that this is completely obliterated? And that would be my concern with regard to, or maybe my question with regard to corporate leniency. And I must say that it seems, looking at the amounts that and the agreements that you are managing to reach, it, to some extent it does work. And but yeah, we need to go deeper on this one, Chair. Myself, I feel it's an issue that really may be some kind of a mini workshop, and to take us through this, so that we understand. Because if you look at the number of cases that the Commission is handling, and the number of cases that go within this bracket, to me, and it's a lot. Now, we talk about 29 billion, and 29 billion and of the total. And now, this 29 billion that you are referring to, is it of the rig, or is it of the total of tenders and that actually went out to the market, or is it the value of the rig and the project? Any, if maybe you refer to the question of the stadiums and so on for the World Cup, were there any arrests and that we managed to come up with in that regard? Chairperson, on this, SAA's Alliance. And in fact, what comes in mind is the question of, especially because part of the mandate is around the question of the and the competition, which to me is the one-time issue, which is fresh in my mind. And does it actually, this, and legislate, if I were to put it that way, or encourage or an accepted collusion as a star line, is it having any impact on smaller and the companies like One Time and so on, and pushing them completely outside of the market and operation, because, and these, the Starlight Alliance SA, are managing to actually take the bigger market and play around and be able to push out the small. And is there any encouragement in your strategy of making sure the survival of such small companies, because there's none that actually exists, and it's SAA's Alliance, and it's acting. In this case, if I've listened to you, it's an approved collusion. And, but it does not say anything about encouragement of small and companies to come to play so that we increase the question of the last one, Chairperson. Supply chain has been dealt with. The question of the graduate trainees, what happens with them? And after you've trained graduate trainees, what happens to them? And do they actually remain behind, inside, or maybe they, and the last one, the stakeholders and the lessons that you pick up with, and the other, and the players, especially within continent, because it cannot be a one way, and
okay.
It must be some kind of a cross-pollination. Thank you.
All right. You know, there are questions that are continuously asked in each and every meeting. The issue of the graduate training has been asked, you know, over and over again, and it has been explained. I think members would know now what is happening around that, because we've been asking that question over and over again, and it has been responded to. Okay. I won't say don't take us back, but I would say that you have a right to get a response. But I would also request that some of these issues, there are other issues I can refer to. But there were answers that we got also from the Commission itself. If members who attended those meetings could respond, it would assist you. Because this is also a form of education to all of us. Thanks. Babu Mabantuli.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson, and I would like to welcome the presentation as well. Chairperson, when we take the example of Walmart mathematics compared with the one time and vis-a-vis SAA, what lessons have we learned from, let's say, when it comes to the conditions for the matters and the public interest, the predatory pricing? Let's say, when you put all these into consideration, what have you learned, what can you tell us? Let's say, if you compare the two, Walmart and the one time vis-a-vis South African Airways, if there are any comparison which you can give us. The chapter scene about this, the trainees, I think the way we're supposed to check here is that with the skills development or with the higher education, they've said, when they were presenting, they've said each and every department entity, there will be a dedicated fund for skills development. Not for the department or for the entity itself, but it will be there for the graduates so that they can be trained and go somewhere and get. I wanted to check because you've got the fund put aside for that, or it's something strange, new. Or have you signed any, I would say, what is it, MO? Minutes of understanding, memorandum of understanding with the Department of Higher Education. That's what we want to establish. Because last time you said, no, you were not aware of that. Now we want to check whether there is. Lastly, Chair, can you be able to give us the number of jobs created or saved through approval and prohibition or prohibited transaction? Is it possible to quantify, say, by doing this, that's what the number of jobs were created or were saved? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Wabun Duli. I don't see the other hand. May I so then ask my question? I'm actually looking Babu Ramburu. I'm looking at your slide, this slide, the enforcement case. I'm trying to understand this, this number, especially on the carried over complaint. Because in your explanation, let me not dwell on that one. But I'm looking at the complaint carried over from the previous year. Let's look at the first 63 and then 46. How many would you say are carried over here? Because it doesn't seem like there is an increase. There is a decrease. It means there are 46 out of the 63. So it means, if I just want to understand what you mean here. Does it mean it's 63 minus 46 are cases that you dealt with, that you were able to deal with and carried over the 46? I just want to understand that. And then let's look at the complaints received from the public. I'm looking at the years 2009-10. I can see that there was high number of complaints received from the public. What's attributable to this, high rise of complaints, especially during this period? Was it the soccer fever? Was it the is it the one that we're talking about around the construction industry? I want to understand that. Bavungo Nyama asked the question around the investigations that are initiated from your side, and he alluded to the fact that he thinks you should be the ones that are initiating more than the public, because you are dealing with this on a daily basis. But if you look at the trend, during the period that I'm asking about, 2009, actually if we can take it back to 2008 to 2010, there's been a little bit of a challenge. I don't understand why the rise in 2009 and then the fall afterwards. What is the why? What was happening within the commission itself? Why did you initiate so many? You know, I'm asking this question because I want to understand exactly what is happening. What is at play here? What's happening within the institution itself? The second question is, you know, I'm looking at ArcelorMittal and Hyperbill issues. There's been lots of inquiries around these issues. And in my knowledge, the knowledge that I have, this has been, you know, pending for some time now. This takes me back to the turnaround time in as far as cases between yourselves and the tribunal. You know, what's the turnaround time? Is it the fact that you don't have enough personnel? Is it because you really have to do that work? What is the, or is it because of other third party, you know, involvement in the whole thing? I just want to understand why is this on the table for such a long time. Especially on these cases that I feel are very important, especially for the market. I have another question on your slide that's dealing with the exemption application. I was trying to find out here because I've been looking for this explanation around the, for more information, not explanation, more information around the Western Cape Citrus Producers Forum. You exempted them with conditions. But I'm not clear of the details because they're not too clearly, you know, appearing in the report as against the Zapia and the Starline issue. What are these conditions? And who is involved here? I just want you to give us a clear picture of what's happening, especially when we look at transformation, because it's clear that the reason why I want to know the conditions is because, you know, the dominance in the market, it might not be in South Africa, it might be now for the purposes of exportation, or export. I don't know whether there's anything like exportation in the language, your English language. But what I want to find out is the dominance of the markets where these exports are heading to. Because it's possible that we can, for instance, want to be merged or want to collaborate and fix some of the things with an intention, a good intention, as far as South Africa is concerned. But in as far as other role players within South Africa, in other markets, it becomes a problem for us. I don't know whether that is clear to you. So that's the reason I'm asking some of these questions. And also on the Health Professional Council of South Africa, I heard what you said, but I'm really not getting the gist of the issue here. I want to know what are the issues here, and whatever relevant detail that you can provide. I had a question on the major issue. Let me go to the question. I wrote it half. I didn't write it in full. So I don't want to waste your time. You see, the challenges that I think I have is conditions related to intermediate measures vis-a-vis, especially on the moratorium on job losses, vis-a-vis conditions, the number of conditions, or is it on the larger measures. The reason I'm asking this is I think you should bear in mind that I don't have enough information in terms of the number of large measures that are at play here. I'm asking this looking at what you provided us. Because when I look at both the large measures vis-a-vis the intermediate, I really don't understand why are they in large numbers. It's because you got a lot of them from the intermediate, because you're approving them, you have an authority to approve. There's a delay, maybe the conditions are not done by, approved by the tribunal, since they have a role to play in as far as large measures are concerned. I just want to get the reasons why we have this picture here in terms of conditions attached to measures. And when I look at investment, other issues or conditions here, for instance, investment obligations, there seem to be none in as far as large measures are concerned. I just want to understand why, because this is information that is for us, why we don't have such in as far as large measures are concerned, because that's where I think we have an opportunity to create jobs as compared to the intermediate measures, where the competition authority, which is good, has an authority, you are able then to approve or to put such conditions. And if I may understand as to how many, for instance, of these measures are we talking about in as far as this, the investment application is concerned. Can I be clarified on restriction of appointment of directors? What do we mean by that, in as far as conditions is concerned? Okay. Can I leave it there at a moment and then come back later before it concludes? I will come to corporate issues after this. I think now I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond.
Okay, thank you, Chair. There's lots of questions, and I hope I'm able to do justice to them.
I will pass on
more difficult questions to members of my team.
Right.
But some of them are going to be just quick, short, annotated answers. So you'll kind of forgive me if I go through them quite quickly. And if there's detail, I'm happy to do that.
Just a second, the first tea outside, those who want it can just get the cup and come back to the meeting. We're not going to wait for them.
Okay, so the first question was on whether our construction and infrastructure project has had an impact on tenders and what that impact has been. I think, is that right?
The impact of tenders on the project, not the interest of the tender collegium on the competitiveness of the industry. Our team is saying that the interest on the tenders and asking the implications of the tenders on the competitiveness.
Are you asking about the way in which tenders are constructed and whether they are put together in a way that facilitates competitive behavior?
Oh, well, that sort of covers the gist, but I was particularly trying to respond to what you were saying earlier about people saying where we should put tenders. When I was saying the setup of the tenders and the processing of tenders in general, what impact does that have on the competitiveness?
And so, I mean, I'm not sure the extent to which that answers your question, but certainly the our intervention has, I think, impacted in the way in which tenders are put out now with this consciousness in mind. In other words, with people who are putting it together very aware of what, you know, it can be part of a kind of risk management strategy, I suppose, what can go wrong here and how do we go about ensuring that this doesn't happen.
I think what he wanted to get for you to come up with that reform or intervention is because of a particular wrongdoing.
Right.
So, how much impact did that wrongdoing have in a whole, you know, process?
Right. Okay.
I think that's what he wanted to find out.
Okay. And primarily to quantify an impact like that, the other way of asking the question would be, how much more has government paid as a consequence of this behavior? You know, how much more have they paid as a consequence that they would have not paid had these bids been competitive?
That's what,
right?
I think you want
that's
to find
right.
out.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
part of your problem statement,
yeah.
for you to come up with a solution that you've come up with.
Yeah. Okay, so how much, so that's the question that has been in our heads and our minds of how to kind of, you know, that there is, we certainly know it would be more, but how much more? Now, how much more is an empirical thing. You know, you'd kind of work it out with real figures, and quite frankly, we haven't done that. We haven't kind of done the calculation of exactly how much more, say, government or private people as well, who put out a tender, would have paid had it not been for the collusion. But there has been a few international studies around this, international studies that basically ask the question, you know, let's look at how much somebody would pay if there's no collusion, and let's look at how much somebody would pay where there is collusion. And between the three studies that we are aware of, we got a big figure that it's between 14 and 20. Between 10 and 30% more, depending on the circumstances. One says 14, you know, but between the three studies that I'm aware of, the range can be anything between 10 and 30% more.
I think what you need to do, perhaps, is to help us with that information, because it is important so that we can see after
right.
your intervention how much impact has your intervention, affected this whole thing. Because at the moment we know what's happening. Some people, instead of 100 million, they would double the price as part of collusion. Others, instead of, you know, companies, in terms of company to company, would be, instead of selling 10 rent per bag of cement, they would say 30 rents, for instance, and that difference is how much, you know, the consumers are suffering as a result of it. I think that is the kind of information he is talking about, and I think it would be helpful if this committee had that kind of information, something that can bring going forward. Yes.
That, Chairperson, the extent to which some deserving companies would have been locked out of the competition and therefore missed up completely, especially the emerging construction companies, SMMEs and so on.
I think that's the information
we
can provide. Fine, yeah.
But, I mean, the point is, just so you know, we haven't kind of calculated this de novo in terms of our particular set of circumstances. We haven't done a calculation for our situation. We're making assumptions on some academic studies that were done. This is an enormously difficult thing to work out with precision in terms of, you know, a methodology of determining it.
But
so, yeah.
The National Treasury could be having such, because I know they have done some work in Palestine, even though it might not be as extensive as what we will be.
Just on that note, if you said the study hasn't been done, you don't have anything, I would imagine that maybe you should, so that you could be able to assess whether the interventions you put in place are yielding results. With the essence of an understanding on your side, you are going to be basically wishing into the dark
you should not know what you're responding to or the extent of the impact which you are responding to. Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thank you. The question about whether we kind of deal with the collusion just in South Africa or in broader, more broadly, you know, well, a big concept in competition law is when you start off, you define a market, and whatever the geographical extent of a particular market is, we must consider that entire geographical extent. So if the market is a Southern African market, as it is in cases, in some construction cases, for example, for big construction projects, then so be it. But our law allows us to take into account any activity that has an impact on the South African economy, irrespective of where it comes from. So in other words, if firms are sitting in the United States and colluding against us, we have jurisdiction over them. The question, and there's kind of a precedent case regarding ANZAC that says that, as clearly as that. Regarding training institutions, we have an annual conference every year that we do together with the Mandela Institute at Fitz University, and there is an institute that's set up at the University of Johannesburg that we collaborate with respect to training, and we have students that doing master's degrees, for example, at UJ, and we send people regularly to the Fitz course as well. So we are kind of beginning to build links with university-based institutions, but more importantly, as I said earlier, we also have links with Palama, which is an institute that trains civil servants on issues, for example, of competition law as it relates to bid rigging, and that's something that takes our work out broader than just our small community, so all our civil, our public sector workers understand the implications of competition law. There were a number of questions about why our complaints. In terms of complaints, there's been a decrease in the complaints initiated by the commission itself. Look, in terms of complaints initiated by the commission itself, we are filling in the gap. In other words, you know, the first thing we look at is who's complaining about what. And usually there's enough to work off there. And if in terms of additional information we have or a scoping research we've done, we found, look, here's a market that there's a problem in. Nobody's complained about it, but we think that it's something to pursue. Then we come in. I mean, I don't think we should be kind of judged to. An indicator should be how many complaints we ourselves are initiating. Because actually, the kinds of complaints we ourselves should be initiating should also be the complaints people out there. It should be similar. It should be the same thing. And we would work off in the first instance of complaints coming from outside the organization. So, you know, it's not kind of, don't say, well, there's fewer complaints initiated by the commission, therefore the commission is not doing its job or not being vigilant enough. Maybe we didn't have to do that because all the complaints by outside parties covered us and we didn't have to fill in the gap, as it were.
What about question to that? Oh, you.
Go ahead,
sir. No. I'll
have it after you. Yeah, I want to respectfully disagree with that point, because I think that the Competition Commission operates not in a vacuum or in isolation from what goes on daily in our lives. You see what goes on, you know about it. In fact, you're closer to it than we are, because that is your area of expertise, and you know what goes on in the country, and you pick it up either through the media or whatever sources of information that's available to the ordinary public. Because if the argument is true, then it would mean that if you don't receive a complaint or something, and that you do recognize that there's a problem, it would mean then that the Competition Commission will not initiate an investigation, and that it would be well within its rights for not doing that. I don't think that that would be satisfactory in the eye of citizens in the country, that if the Competition Commission does not actively pursue investigation. My view is, I think that is a very important part of your mandate.
Simon Robert. I'm not going to allow many follow-ups, Bandla, please. Babu, Onyam.
Walter, I just want to, disagree with my, colleague here, because in my view, and they were debating here, because we're trying to find solutions, and so that's the mindset that I have. In my view, if we are to encourage active citizenry, active participation by citizens in advancement of our democracy, and in ensuring that we have clean governance, and we ensure that there is a equitable distribution of the resources of the country, it cannot be that we'll rely on the commission and the chair. I'm mindful also of the fact that, much as I say this, if we look at this on the senior management capacity, few as they are, but they are still vacancies, and I don't know why they are vacancies. And with a commission that is so much and small. So my issue, Chairperson, comes to the involvement of the public and educating the African public to be able to be on the lookout and assist in ensuring that we clean our society of any form of anti-competition tendencies, as well as and the issues relating to collusion. So my issue is that it's both sides. The commission...
You are not differing. You are just saying there should be balance.
Absolutely.
Balance.
But the issue with me, Teresa, that I want to insist on, is that African society must be educated. It must be the role of the commission to educate African society so that they participate, they see themselves as partners in the fight.
Okay. I think the persons we are that are before us today is the Competition Authority. And the one we are dealing with now is Competition Commission. So any issue that we are raising directed to them so that they can clarify us. And that clarity is a form, is a way of educating us on how they see the working. And I agree that doesn't mean that they'll be always correct. That's why we are here, so that you can also advise where possible in terms of how they function. And this is the area that we are busy following up. I'm looking at this at your executive. There's a chief economist and manager, policy and research, whom, in my view, is supposed to be dealing with the issues related to the ones we're talking about. Watching out at the market, how the market functions, issues of the... The anti-competitive issues, especially at a particular level in response to your mandates and so forth. So that where the public doesn't come in, you are able to come in before even the public come in on certain issues, because the public might not be aware of their role in as far as some of the issues are concerned. And you being the leader, you should be the one therefore doing that work. That's why I was coming in as a follow-up to say, what is then your role as, do you have a person or a unit that is dealing with this kind of issues? Let's say a public doesn't say anything, and you are aware. You have a person that on a daily basis is entrusted with the responsibility of watching out, of being vigilant on issues, you know, related to this, what we're talking about here. And that person is not doing anything. What would you do? I'm not doing anything at all, but, you know, you are working. Sometimes you might be seen busy, but you are not business-like. And we don't see impact. Hence, we're asking this this question. And I was following up on what you were saying.
I'm not going to answer the question, Commissioner, still going to answer, but just to provide you with context. In fact, the slide sets it up very nicely. If you check in the earlier years, there were very, very few complaints that were initiated by the Commission. And the tricky number that is admittedly slowly going up. It went particularly up around 2009, 2010. And that's really a function of our prioritization work. What has happened is that traditionally, the commission has tended to be dependent on complaints that were coming from the outside. I don't think there's something necessarily wrong with members of the public complaining. But what our own initiated complaints do is to focus us on very few, not many, very few, but very important areas. So if you look at the commissioner's initiated investigations, they tend to be on priority sectors. They tend to be very specific. Some of the problems we have right now about people challenging the complaints, the scope of our complaints, is because often a member of the public didn't really file it properly or wasn't clear enough about what was happening. So we try to do some background work on a few sectors and initiate on those. And that work has been trickling up. And of course, we do that, because we have control on the numbers, we then can balance that with resources. Very difficult to balance resources with what's coming up with members of the public. But also is that although the public has been very helpful in bringing complaints, some of them, if you look at those numbers, a whole lot of them are actually complaints that we refer away or we don't pursue further. So people will complain about something and we would refer it to the Consumer Commission sometimes. Sometimes we would refer it to ICASA, depending on whoever is relevant. So ours are more focused, but there are fewer. And I don't think they will ever match the number of those coming from the public.
But I think that's where we are. We need explanation, clarification, because it's not coming out clearly here. Because it's like you are, for instance, as these cases are appearing, numbers, these are cases before you that go through you, but you don't tell us how many have you referred, for instance, to where, and so forth, because that information is very important to us. We need to know. I asked a question on the period 2008 to 2010 deliberately because I was seeing those trends, and I wanted to know. My question was, what's attributed to those numbers, you know, rising? Because going forward, you can see a decline. We don't know what will happen in this financial year. It might be further decline, we don't know. What happened during that period that so many cases being initiated by yourself as against other years? And here we can see that they are going down. There must be something that would have prompted you to initiate that. That was another question.
Okay, and what that is that you find that the period you're talking about coincides with the detailed strategic planning that the commission does once every 3 years. So what would happen is we do this detailed strategic planning in that, you know, as with all strategic planning, one has to prioritize as to what are the most important things to deal with. It's out of those, that exercise, for example, that our prioritization sectors emerge. And out of that, we say that we're prioritizing the steel sector or the food sector, and then our researchers would do a scoping exercise and say, in the food sector, let's look at all the different markets in the food sector and where there might be a problem, and where there might be a bigger problem than, and where there might be a smaller problem, and that will enable us to prioritize. When we do that exercise and we find, hey, you know, here's a market that in terms of our prioritization, our strategic planning is important, but we haven't got a complaint from a member of the public here, then we'll step in and we will do that initiation, and we'll take that forward. But invariably, there is a huge correlation between what we identify as a problem and what the public complains of. I mean, I think there's an opposite assumption being made in some of the questions. And so in most instances, we don't have to fill in that gap to do an independent initiation on behalf of the commissioner. And that's how it should be. There should be a lot of the correlation between what we identify as problems and what the complaints are should be correlating. Otherwise, we have a problem. Otherwise, people are complaining about one thing and we're deciding that something else is a priority. And I think that's the reason why we you're unlikely to get there being more initiations by the commission and fewer by the public. We must be guided by the public in terms of what people's real problems are. And the victims of competition behavior, anti-competitive behavior.
With due respect, Mr. Rambaros, I think the contradiction there. On the other hand, you are saying through your stress plan you are seeing a loophole and you close it to self-initiation. On the other hand, you are saying we should leave that to the public to do that. I really find it very confusing. Maybe what we need to get here is in terms of the issues here, because I suspect, I'm not saying it like that, I suspect looking at the period, it might have had to do with the period we were in. This is twofold. It's in relation to the economic crisis, wherein people can see we are not doing well and let's therefore, collude so that we can up our profits. It could be that you realize that also there is, the building construction, there are challenges, and you said, let's do something around that. This is how the trend is telling me in terms of your graphs there. So what I would want you to help us with, because really, unless you clarify that factually clarify that, meaning that you give us the actual reasons for that high and low, and the period in between, that is exclusive of the period under review, I think that might be the only thing that convinces us. As you gave us the picture, can you also support that with information so that we can have a clearer understanding? Because the way we are going about, I don't see us really agreeing on some of these things. Can we agree on that, members? Please, here, Eastern Cape, KwaZulu Natal meeting, in my meeting. That was on a lighter note. But remember, I just want your confirmation on this. We are saying we need them to give us clear information, more information, so that you can have what we need is common understanding based on information. Sexual information, so that tomorrow if we are to explain the situation, we are able to do so. Remember, this is not the Competition Commission's information only. This is meant for public. And as people who are stakeholders of the Competition Commission, we might be asked about these things and we might not be able to clarify. For us to be in a position to explain even further, we need this kind of information. Especially this one of initiating, because remember we challenge them to go to the people, inform people as much as possible, so that people can be able to participate in an informed manner. Hence the queries that there are issues that are referring to other institutions or other role players that do not belong to them. This might be a sign that people are not yet aware of the role of the Competition Commission vis-a-vis other stakeholders. So it is a challenge to the competition authorities to inform people about the work that they are doing, what is to come to them, what is not to come to them, so that as they send complaints, they know exactly what to send and what not to send. So if we can get that information, we'll appreciate it so that we are able to advise them soundly. We may proceed to the next issue. You need 5 minutes break. We're going to eat on your time, Mr. Mano.
We're happy to cooperate with the commission in this respect.
You
constitutional duty, yes.
If you cooperate, then you must, so that we limit the questions to yourself. Cooperate even in responses, because you're working close. together. Yeah. We can have that 5 minute break. Thank you.
Is this a reality TV coming to the same magazine?
I guess.
We have to. you know, it's like a race of people who have so much covering their issues.
I'm very sensitive.
Yeah, and then from that you'll see something interesting. And I think it's kind of like my face, like a formulaic story. We don't use root visual sensor because we don't cover it.
No, And all of them are going to do the same thing.
Ma, if it is so, I said, Ma, le retirement est cadi. Comment je viens de dire que j'ai un
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, so the next question I've got on my list has to do with the controls around the procurement of legal services that we put in place that are satisfied. Okay, so essentially here, this is because this is a deviation from the strict rules of the PFMA. There is a process that the PFMA suggests around deviation. We have a specially prepared memo that is signed off by the chief accounting officer myself. So I've got to take responsibility in the end for that decision. But that essentially satisfies the auditors. But what we put into place and we're in the process of refining now is we will have a database of all our service providers with respect to legal services and, for that matter, economic expertise, economists. And we will manage that database in a way that's consistent with how databases ought to be managed according to PFMA rules. In other words, they'll be continuously be updated, and we will kind of assess the proficiency or the, you know, in other words, if some lawyer in the database and has worked well for us in one case, we will note it in terms of procuring the service for future cases. So we're gonna, and so right now we have a system where all of these decisions are taken in EXCO, in our collectively, although I sign off it in the end through a memo that brought to us, and that memo justifies why a particular lawyer should be appointed in a particular case. There's been a lot of questions around SAA.
I apologize to interrupt. Just on the previous question, if you'd allow just a very brief follow-up. I'm mindful of the time. The one with regards to legal services. And I don't expect you to provide the... sorry, can I proceed?
Is it a follow-up or is it a new question?
It's follow-up on exactly the same thing.
Okay.
I understand that you may not have the information available, but is it possible that you could probably provide at some stage through a written reply the work that has been allocated to Black?
Yes,
I mean, to attorney services.
This is well currently in progress, and we will do. We are, you know, we engage with it right now, so yes, we can.
I think I'm happy, Mr. Amburu, on this question, because you remember previously you used to say, no, we can't do that. But now, you know, I'm happy that the auditor general challenged you. And it looks like it's doable. And it is doable because you're supposed to put in within, because the treasury note, practice note, it indicates that you must have that list of...
Okay, so now the
difficult questions around SAA. I hope I'm going to kind of cover all of these because there's a specific issue here and there's a more general issue. So the argument is being made that because one-time airline went under, the argument is being made that the main reason that's occurred is because South African Airways is predatory pricing through subsidizing Mango, that this is a competition issue, and why is the Competition Commission doing nothing about this? That's the basically
the criticism being leveled at us, the way I understand it. Firstly, predatory pricing is a very specific concept in the Competition Act. It's something that a dominant firm does. There are very specific pieces of evidence. There's a particular way of analyzing it. Essentially, predatory pricing is where a dominant firm brings down its price to such an extent that competitors cannot compete at that low price. Competitors go out of business, and then the dominant firm has complete reign of the market and can raise the price to whatever level they want to. And this making the call that there is indeed predatory pricing requires quite substantive amounts of data around input costs, how much, you know, whatever. You need to detail all the costs, and then you need to say, well, what the price they're charging is below this cost. It's a very factual, empirical exercise that gets done in economics, and it gets proved in that way. In order for a competition agency like ours to proceed on a case like that, we would have to have, and I suppose this goes to the previous debate we've had, in order for us to kind of initiate any investigation, we have to be reasonably satisfied that we have sufficient, this has to be a decision made on reasonableness. You know, that look, chances are, given what we know, given the evidence, that this is something that's going to fly in terms of the strict kind of legal hurdles one has to pass to make the case. In the case of South African Airways, we certainly the first few of the complaints from Natasha, whatever, I can't remember her name, was not one that was based on that kind of reasoning. It was based, you know, that was, it was in fact, it was a very, you know, it was kind of, as came out in the press statement, was go and raid SABC, I mean, go and raid South African Airways. That's not something we can just do on a whim, just go and raid a firm. You know, you've got to have, like, reasonable grounds that something is occurring here. And should those kinds of reasonable grounds emerge, and should there be any evidence that this is indeed happening, we will, of course, proceed with an investigation. We will. We are considering at the moment the second complaint that's come from Comair. We haven't concluded on that yet. But should there be reasonable grounds for us to continue, you know, rest assured we have, and we have in the past also had cases against South African Airways, so that's not a kind of issue around that. But I think the point I'd only like to make here is that we can't take big prosecutorial decisions like that just on kind of sentiment alone. There has to be something more substantive for us to proceed into a case like that. The big issue around the other big issue with respect to South African Airways has to do with who owns South African Airways rather than how it behaves in the marketplace. And we have clear jurisdiction around a firm's behavior in what ought to be a competitive market. We have jurisdiction there, but we have no jurisdiction around who should or should not be owning a firm. That is a bigger policy issue you know, questions need to be directed at those responsible for that policy area. In other words, people should be asked to justify why you're owning the firm. What are the public interest reasons you're doing so? And that is a reasonable question to ask, and they probably they may be reasonable answers to that.
It's an interesting debate, I must say, and especially with regard to the airlines, because I am listening quite attentively to the response, because the idea of the mandate of the commission, the essence of it is the impact to the consumer, and the essence of the impact to the small man or small lady in South Africa. And with regard to the airline, SAA, Star Alliance, I dare say that in terms of, we talk about the national airline, by the way, so
by sentiments towards them. But I have to balance that with the pricing and the impact of that pricing to an honorary provider. Because if you look at the flow of passengers in all the airports in South Africa, you find that they represent the economic structure of South Africa. They represent the economic structure of South Africa, which means that something has to be done there. So I'm a bit worried when and Mr. Ramaros says, yes, this thing needs more information or scientific information. Who has to do that? When many people actually make or come up with complaints over an issue like this, which I'm sure, and as a fellow can yourself, and you should be sensitive to that, and the commission should be sensitive because there's so much about it, Chair. And so I would imagine that the commission would take the responsibility of even getting deeper into it, rather than waiting that I should actually go there and try and get information, or somebody must go there and try and get information. There should be a way that the commission is sensitive to a matter. Just to set an example, a flight from Johannesburg to Cape Town is much more cheaper than a flight from Johannesburg to Eastland or Johannesburg to Port Elizabeth or to Nelspruit for that matter. And I'm just making a case for the ordinary people. That's why you will never change the economic structure and the passenger and the...
I can see this is quite an interesting topic, and I agree that we need to discuss this, but the time is too short for us to discuss this. And I suggest that perhaps we do a public hearing on this, just to get how people, you know, understand the whole issue. Because in this case, we will have a balanced view. Because otherwise, we are going to come in and explain why. I, for one, want to take part in the debate. If I were to, I know Wabuntulu wants to take part in this debate, and everyone else. So it might take longer because we have different views on this issue and the different understanding on this particular issue vis-a-vis the policies in place. With respect to this. So I would say, for the benefit or for the sake of this meeting, let's really leave it to the competition issue around the case that's before the Competition Commission, and also leave it, Mr. Rambur, to the level or to the extent that excluding some of the comments that you've made, to the extent that you are busy dealing with the matter with respect to Infascom Air's consent, because the matter is before you as referred to by Com Air with the facts that they have. And you indicated that the matter that has been referred to by Natasha to yourself did not have the business for investigation, did not have anything to hold on to. But now that you have something to hold on to, this is matter in progress. And we should leave it at that and on our side, so that we are able also to get a balance from ourselves and from the public out there. Let's have that it can be it can be in a form of a public hearing if you want to. It can be in a form of social dialogue. Yeah, it's more social dialogue than a public hearing, to be honest. I think we must have a social dialogue around this issue. Yes, that's where everybody will have enough opportunity to discuss. Are we agreeing on that? I'm just putting it as a way forward. Otherwise, we only left with a few minutes, and we haven't introduced the tribunal.
Yeah, I don't want to make your job difficult, and I do understand the time constraints, but I absolutely have to raise the issue. And the commissioner made the point that on the basis of the complaint that he received, he did not think that there was sufficient evidence in there to investigate. But if I'm understanding that properly, you have a responsibility to do that in terms of the provisions of Act. If you receive a complaint, to investigate. That for me is the key issue here. Is there a discussion for you to say, yes, I should or shouldn't? From what I'm understanding, Act is that you have to do it.
With your respect, Mr. Hussein, I think there are many issues that he had responded like this. It's not only the only case that he has responded like that. There were other issues that we were not happy about previously, where Mr. Romburu said there's no sufficient case, that's why we had to, basis, that's why we had to refer, or we had to put it aside or so. So that's what I'm saying, please, that's because this, to me, forms part of the whole picture. Let's leave it to the dialogue and leave you to, so that we don't prolong this, because we're going to come in, it's going to prolong the whole thing. If it, with your respect, Mr. Hussein, please, let's allow it to be like that. I understand you have a serious issue. Yes, you see? So it becomes, it is going to be a very long, protracted issue. When it comes to competition issues, that's why last time you had to be very angry, because we are raising some of these things, you know? And unfortunately, this has to do with the lives of our people. That's why we're saying, let's have a dialogue. Let's agree. You prepare sufficiently, Mr. Hussein, Babu Onyama, and whoever is interested, and we all prepare.
I'm surprised at the hypocrisy of the alliance.
Can I stop you? Can I stop you? Can I stop you, Babu Ntuli? I know you are a whip. You want to whip. Can I stop you and say I just concluded on the matter, and let's proceed. You will hear that a lot in the dialogue, I guess. A lot of what Babu Ntuli is saying. So, for now, preserve the energy. Can we continue, please?
Chair, it is important for me to just clarify one thing. The test for a commissioner to proceed with an investigation is not not sufficient evidence in the way that you're putting it. It's not, you know, obviously, when you investigate...
Can I stop you? Because I'm aware of what you're saying, because I also wanted to say to Mr. Hussein, please give us the relevant...
The point I want to make is that this is reasonable grounds.
I wanted to ask him to give us the relevant clause that he's referring to, but that will come during the dialogue. Can you please leave it there? So I've ruled on this matter. Can we proceed, please, to the next question?
Okay.
Yes.
There were questions that we'll deal with in terms of this. We've agreed a way forward as directed by the chair on all cases that were initiated by the commission versus complaints. So I'm going to leave that question out. There's a question about large mergers and investment and job creation. Okay. So here, you know, the first thing I think we must appreciate is mergers, by their very nature, results in job losses. It's just how things are. If you're merging two firms with each other, you know, you can't have two CEOs, you can't have two heads of finance, you can't have two heads of procurement. You're getting two firms together, invariably somebody loses their job. There are instances when there's a complete, when one firm is completely taking over another firm footstool as it is, perhaps that doesn't happen. But, you know, going with the territory of mergers are job losses. That's just how it is. Our job is to limit those job losses and to ensure that where they do occur, that workers are treated properly in the retrenchment process. That's what we do. So that's what we ensure, that, you know, every effort is made to counsel workers, to find them other jobs, in some instances to put up a training fund so they can be reskilled and get employment elsewhere. So I think that needs to be appreciated. So, you know, it's not as though obviously there is a situation where after some period of time the merged entity becomes more competitive and then after some time lag will expand and then more jobs will be created. And that's the hope, and that a lot of kind of business plans argue that. You know, in a business plan we merge, we'll cut some jobs, and as they will grow afterwards. So it's not, you know, but in the immediate term we often face with the problem of having to limit these job losses. So in terms of our our methodology here is we attempt to ensure that when a merger occurs, as directed by the Competition Act, the merging parties engage in a bona fide fair way with the unions in order to negotiate any job losses going forward. We check with the unions that that's happening, and often we are asked to, when a merging party says X number of jobs are to be lost, and the unions are anxious that they might increase that number, or they might not stick to the word, their word, we make that number a condition to approving that merger. In other words, you should not retrench beyond that particular number. Regarding investment-type remedies, these are very rare and few and far between. I mean, the Competition Act requires merging parties to notify unions of the intention to merge at the same time that they notify the competition authorities. So unions are kind of drawn in. Their capacity to participate is variable, but there certainly is a requirement for them to know about what's happening. Regarding the investment remedies, as I'm saying, you know, kind of whether beyond a merger there is or is not investment is not a directly competition issue. In other words, with or without investment, it will not necessarily always affect the competition analysis. Very often as part of a business plan in merging, two parties merging, there will be plans on how they will expand in the future, but that's often not something that becomes a major competition issue, you know, a variable in the competition analysis. Often investments are, quite frankly, offered by merging parties as a kind of sweetener to say, look, you know, we'll kind of merge and look at what further investment will bring in, and that's fair enough, but it's not something that's often a kind of contingent to the merger occurring. So that's not something that occurs very often, quite frankly. Then there were questions about interns. Should I skip that, or do you want interns? Basically, we have our graduate training program. We get about 15 to 20 people every year that come in. They're there for a 12-month or 18-month contract as new employees. Some of them leave and get other jobs elsewhere, but many of them stay behind in the commission and get absorbed into the commission, many of them. We have many of our staff have come to us in the first instance as graduate trainees. I think Mahale might be one of them, if I'm not mistaken. So Mahale came to us way back as a graduate trainee and is now a senior person in the organization. Why is there a drop in administrative penalties? Okay, so in the previous year where it was very, very high, we had one firm that paid 500 million rands in fine. That's Pioneer. You know, that was one single firm. And you can see in the subsequent year, we had many firms with some of them very modest fines. There were three or four with fines above 100 million. So we had many more firms fined in the subsequent year with a lower amount. In the previous year, we had an outlier in the form of Pioneer. Remember, these were the people who didn't, who challenged our bread cartel prosecution with Tiger settled. With us, they decided they not settle. They challenged it, and it went all the way to a tribunal decision levied a fine on them, and subsequent to that, they negotiated with us to settle all remaining matters, and that was a big fine that comes under that previous financial year. Chair, there is a point around the CLPs and deterrence, but I think you wanted a more detailed session on that. Can we leave that to a more detailed session? Thank you. The 29 billion rand that was spoken about, this was kind of figure that we kind of started off with way back when. I'm not sure if it's a great figure to bandy around now, but it was an assumption we made when we started the project that the infrastructure spend was 29 billion rand. The under two arrests was no, there has been no arrest. This is our proceedings are not criminal in nature. We work off civil law and the firm gets fined, but there's no arrest of individuals and there's no criminal prosecution in terms of the Competition Act. Graduate trainees. Okay. Then the question around corporate governance and management problems. Here, you're quite right, there was a letter that was sent by a staff member to the DG complaining of myself, the CEO, and my behavior, claiming a whole range of things that staff member was unhappy with. Following that, there was an initial investigation by the department, by EDG. They've produced a report in terms of that initial investigation. I have responded to that report, so I've written a response to that report. This occurred about 2 months ago, and I haven't heard from EDG yet on this matter. So this matter should be picked up again with EDG on where we are in the process. What's the next? Oh, okay. So then the question was, in terms of the Walmart merger and one-time SAA, what lessons have we learned? I think some of this should be still left to the issue around the proposal you have around looking at the SAA issue more detail. But just to point out that...
Commissioner Lambrouf, can you switch that to her? The chairperson has requested that she's got a meeting, so I will continue up one because I've received so many letters. People are excusing them for other meetings at once. So I would suggest, if you agree, that... can't we leave these questions because we request that we continue in January with these responses. But I'm proposing that let's give the tribunal to table there so that when we come back, we just deal with the questions instead of starting a rash presenting because they've been here from morning. I'm saying we've got enough time to respond to what we have asked, and then the tribunal will give them just a table, and then when they come back, we can ask questions. If you can agree so that we take that route instead of for them coming whole day, then they've gone back without doing anything. We are going to finish this meeting at 1. So if you agree, then I will just stop you there and give the tribunal to take us through. I've had that move. You want to say something?
Through your chair.
What I want to say
here is that I've got a little bit of a concern that we have presentations that we rush through, we don't exhaust. And this is not the first time that we have had two groups presenting to us, and then we don't get the full, because of the time constraint. I think in this case, it would have been very nice if we had also a good time to interrogate the tribunal. Because the way it is, I'm talking about now. I think maybe in the future, Chair, that we should not bring two groups at the same time and then we don't get a full picture. Because this is, we are doing injustice, not only ourselves, but Parliament as well. Thank you.
Thanks. My meeting was supposed to be first, but the thing is 1 o'clock now. I think I have more time. Just on that, I think the... You see, it depends on your mood sometimes also. You know, there are times when we take 30 minutes or 1.5 hours. Yes, when I say your mood, I mean our mood, all the committee's mood. And it's sometimes I understand that there are pressure somewhere, then you come in with, you know, full force, well prepared. Sometimes you come in, quap, done, and going. So what I'm trying to say to you, while you're challenging, I think, us on the management, on the program, I think we should also challenge ourselves on how do we, on our consistency in interacting on issues. Can we agree that that should be, because yes, we agree that this matter, the tribunal, we can postpone to January because we don't have further time. We postpone to first thing in January we deal with you. We were supposed to wrap up now, but we're not going to wrap up until January. And then we allow then Mr. Ramburu to conclude on the issue. So you don't mind, Mr. Manuel?
Sure, we don't mind at all. I think it makes sense that we do start afresh the next time round rather than stop doing it halfway. We have no objection, Chair, we understand the situation.
Okay. You'll be more in the alliance with the DA. I think when we come back, that's why you're saying that. Let's allow Mr. Ramburu to conclude, please, with the responses. We have only.
I don't have many else because I've covered most of the ones, but as I was saying, I know you haven't responded to mine. I don't know if there are other outstanding ones.
Yes.
Okay. So I'll stop by saying the one time the question was what lessons we learned from the Walmart merger that can be applied to the one-time situation. Just remember that the Walmart merger was a merger that required specifically that we take into account certain public interest issues, and that was the issue there. That was a merger context. In the one-time SAA situation, we're talking about an accusation of abuse of dominance on the part of SAA. So it's not exactly the same context we're talking about. One's a merger, one is a dominant firm abusing its dominance through predatory pricing. But we've already agreed that we're going to look at the SAA matter in greater detail at another point. With regards to training, I'd answer some of this in terms of what we do our graduate trainees. And the question here was specifically about a fund being set aside. Well, there's no fund as such, but we budget for training. So one of our budget items in our financial planning is around training, and I suppose that's equivalent to a fund at some level, and we also contribute to the Skills Development Fund, Skills Development Levy, which we can claim back from as per normal procedures of that. In other words,
I think what Mr. Ntula is talking about is the agreement with the Department of Higher Education. In their green paper, they have that, you know, it's a proposal in terms of assisting in skilling our people, that you train people above what you have, and then you have to report on an annual basis as to how many people have you contributed in skilling in the whole country for economic purposes. But it's outside your normal 1% levy issues and all that. It's outside that. I think this is something you can talk to going forward. You don't have a response that you can
give. We haven't reported on that in this financial year. We will in the next financial year report on that. But I think that we would be in the... we would be in the ballpark of contributing, appropriately to meet those objectives. There were questions around, there are your questions. The one question we've looked at in terms of the graph, and you've raised that about issues, and we'll kind of clarify that, so that was a big question. Then there's a question around ArcelorMittal and the turnaround times. Okay, and there's just two points I want to make around this, is that, firstly, don't see the name of company and think we're talking about the same case all the time. Okay, so ArcelorMittal is a company that makes slab steel, that makes long steel, and the way we define our cases, of course, are according to the specific market. So it's a long steel case or a flat steel case. So,
and, how long is this?
Okay, I'm not sure specifically this case, how long. Yeah. It has taken a substantively long period of time. And there are issues, and there have been a number of other questions here on our case management, which I'll kind of, I think other people have asked about this in turnaround time. Just remember that in the course of prioritization, what invariably happens is you look at everything in front of you and you say, which are the most important things to deal with? And you, in terms of, you know, what urgency and impact and a whole range of criteria, and you prioritize. So we continuously prioritize, and there are invariably going to be cases that are not going to be prioritized and take longer. That's part of our prosecutorial discretion, that we can, you know, we prioritize cases that are more important or have a greater impact. So there are cases that take longer than others, and that is a consequence of our prioritization process, of us asking the question what is more important and what is less important. So that's the one thing. But the other thing, and this is not necessarily true in us in this particular case of ArcelorMittal, but the other thing that that makes our cases take longer than they ought to is the fact that they are often and it's been a significant number, I think, of procedural challenges that get put in the way of us taking a case to the merits in terms of competition law. And we've reported on this consistently over the years, that, you know, we haven't taken this because so-and-so objected to some procedural point, and we've got to go and sort out that procedural point. And some of them have taken us 4 or 5 years, insofar as those cases that went up to the Constitutional Court are concerned, to sort out. And while you're sorting out one matter on a matter of procedure, a whole bunch of other cases that are, that were similar in procedure to the one that's been tackled get put on the side, get put on the back burner. We'll come back to this when we've unblocked whatever the procedural challenge has been. So it is true that cases take longer, but there's a whole range of reasons for that.
What informs your prioritization?
Well, what informs our is precisely the kinds of things we've raised previously here. Our prioritization is based on attacking cases that affect poor consumers, hence all the food cases, tackling cases that are intermediate industrial products because we want to improve manufacturing, that is in the case of ArcelorMittal, for example, and Sasol, tackling cases that increase the cost of doing business. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, crunch line is that we would take forward cases that have a good chance of success in the tribunal because we feel we've collected sufficient evidence to be very convincing in winning that case.
Just a follow-up on your question. You know, the once we appreciate the whole input by the commission chair, but in my view, as a member of parliament, what is of significance is to link up with the question, what is it that you consider when you prioritize? The question of job creation, as it was somebody actually amongst us raised the issue, it must come out from the presentation. Somebody raised, I think it was a question of transformation, and because we continue to have the distorted economic structure that we have, if the competition does not make an impact in that and open the space for participation at the small and medium enterprise, such issues must actually come very, very clear so that the input that is presented to us speaks to the priorities and of the economy broadly. And so to me, to just talk about cases outside job creation, outside transformation of the economy and stuff like that, it does not have a punch.
That's why I'm asking this question about Mr. Rambo. I forgot to introduce Mani Mokhoro. She's also a member from the ANC. She joined us a bit late after I had introduced everyone. This takes us back to those issues that we discussed earlier this year about the mandate and what really guides you. I think it's very important that we look into that. I'm worried that we are just nearing the 1 o'clock. That's why I'm asking what informs, because issues of
we talked ArcelorMittal, the issues around the pricing. We talking now, I'm not sure what is the issue around the Hassel Steel and ArcelorMittal and so forth. I think those issues in terms of your prioritization should talk to what is before the country at the moment in terms of the priorities of the country. This is very important to align what you are doing to the new growth path, to the national development plan, to the industrial policy action plan. It is very, very important, because if you do so, then we'll understand even the issues that you are raising in terms of your prioritization vis-a-vis your capacity in terms of personnel capacity. Very, very important. So it calls on you really to look into these issues as you go. I don't know when are you going for strategic plan, to really look at how you look at some of these issues, how you prioritize, and how you ensure that your establishment, you know, is at par with the work that's before you. Otherwise, we'll be coming back and back and back discussing one and the same thing. Can we request that you do that? Because to me, it looks like there's a lot of things that are really hanging, going there and there and there and there, that are not really gelling and moving together with the country as the country is moving. I'm not trying to undermine the work that you're doing, but I know that you're doing a lot of work and you're putting a lot of effort. Your area is highly technical, sometimes can be confusing to other people, including ourselves. But as we gain knowledge, we become more wiser and knowledgeable and able then to interact with you on these issues, and can see that members are beginning now to ask questions that are really helping the country. And that's why I wanted to close what I'm doing now. I'm just saying the final words for the committee, and then we'll allow you also to close so that we move forward to the next year. What I'm saying is that you set up targets, you don't meet targets. As I look at your report, it's like your 49% of your targets are not met. And it's something that when you go to your threat plan, you have to look at. What is wrong? The issue around the challenges with the management, are there those challenges? And what is contributing towards that? Obviously, people are not happy, are not going to be to produce, and they're going to be productive. What are you doing to encourage people to participate, to be free, to be more productive, so that they can grow? Because it's not about you as people who are working in the competition authorities. It's about what you are doing for your country, the end product, what your work, how your work impacts on the rest of the people. That is what is important. So what you are saying is that please ensure that when you look at your work, put more effort into the issues we are, because we are a country in transformation. And transformation is never easy. So we want all of our efforts to go towards that, towards transformation. And we believe that competition authorities have an important role to play in helping the country transform itself. So we have a lot of confidence in you. Please help us through that. As much as we acknowledge your work and commend the work that you're doing, we feel we are not putting a lot of agency into the issues before the table. So this is what we are saying. But we want to really congratulate you on the efforts that you are putting so far. We know there are challenges in the process of doing work. We are saying, remember that you're not alone, you're with other people. And sometimes if you are alone there, you think everything is going well or everything's going, not like that. Think that there are people outside there. And as you rest for the festive season, please gather as much energy as possible, because this country is still far away from achieving its goals. So help us that when you come back in January, you are much fresher and much more dedicated to and committed to your work. We want to wish you a very pleasant festive season. Be safe and come back as you are and even more. That's on behalf of the committee. May we hand over to you. Yes. Over to you, Mr. Ramboros and the team.
Well, Chair, I mean, all that's left for me to say thank you very much for this opportunity and for a further future opportunity to explain this, which we'll take up, and we'll be pleased to come back and deal with these matters in more detail. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you as well, and we appreciate why we couldn't present today, but it's been very valuable for us to hear the exchange with the Commission because we cover the same issues, so we benefited as well from your question, and hopefully we can have a more focused presentation when we present you next time. And again, best wishes to the members of the committee, and we look forward to seeing you next year.
Should have been voted for you today.
Thank you.